Hi there. Welcome to Outrageous, a bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, media, culture, politics, and everything in between. My name is Chris. I'm in New York City, and usually I'm joined by my two very best friends, Jason in D.C. and Trisha in L.A. However, we are on a short, semi-short break from the podcast, and because we didn't want to leave you guys hanging, I dove into the archives and found a previously recorded, previously unreleased podcast that we had done in June of 2015. So check out our slightly dusty yet still outrageous discussion about Rachel Dolezal, Black Lives Matter, and what it can learn from the marriage equality movement, and that always fun discussion, what is up with Republicans?
To the Benjamin Banneker Homestead, which is a National Historical Site in Baltimore County, which I'm embarrassed to say I had never been to before because it's right outside Baltimore, and I feel like I typically visit a lot of historical sites. First of all, it's just very well done. It's beautiful just physically. And then I learned a ton about Benjamin Banneker, and I feel like I feel like prior to going, I knew more than the average American, but there's so much I didn't know, and like what a fascinating person and a fascinating story. Just amazing.
Who the hell is Benjamin Banneker?
Oh my God.
There we go. He was a free black man in the late 18th century.
Oh man, I'm gonna be shamed in public now that I didn't know this.
Who owned a great deal of land. What I learned there is he was a descendant of an indentured servant who worked her way out of servitude, bought two slaves, freed them, and then married one. And the one she married was a prince of a Senegalese tribe.
She's doing everything right. Wow.
So exactly. And then, so he became an astronomer, and he wrote an almanac, six editions he published himself. And he actually, along with a pair of local white men brothers, the Ellicott brothers, for whom Ellicott City is named in Baltimore County, I'm sorry, in Howard County, they surveyed the land that would become Washington, D.C. They, like, drew the border. So he had this enormous impact at a time when most black people were slaves. He even, I believe, wrote a letter, like a famous letter to George Washington, basically proving that, like, black people can learn to read and write, and if they're taught to, they can make significant contributions to the country, which he was doing.
You know what? I feel like whenever I hear these stories about these freed blacks of yore, I'm always like, what the hell am I doing? Like, these people are slaves, and they managed to go from slavery to being an astronomer? I was like, I need to use three times this morning.
Oh. No, I totally agree. I mean, I feel that way, especially when you read the writings of some of them, especially, like, when I read Frederick Douglass, and I'm like, here's a guy who, like, you know, someone secretly taught to read, like, here and there in the night by candlelight, and his writing is so incredibly amazing and so much better than mine or, you know, the vast majority of people's. It is very humbling just to see, you know, whence some people came, and here we are, we've had college, you know.
And we have every advantage.
We're not nearly as intelligent or as accomplished.
I know. As our advanced degrees, every possible, you know, privilege we could have had, well, maybe not everyone, but, like, and still, I am not an astronomer or...
Or an author.
Or an author.
Yeah.
I've never even written anything.
Which, by the way, it seems to me historically, any reasonably intelligent person who could read and write did. Right? Or maybe we just started getting a selection.
To be fair.
Self-selection.
To be fair, I mean, what else was there to do, right?
That's true.
Or you read and you write. I mean, maybe that's something true for another podcast, but like,
If they had Mortal Kombat, then they would have been just as unaccomplished as you, Chris.
Let me tell you something. If those slaves had Mortal Kombat, the history of the country might be a little different. Just saying. They would have played that and said, I have an idea. On that dark note, let's jump right into the topics. Trisha should go first.
Since I don't remember my topic.
You know what your topic is.
Anyway, my topic was really as a result of some of the things that happened in the news the last month or so. I think it was, first of all, it was Caitlyn Jenner coming out of, I guess, the transgender closet. Is there a transgender closet? But It's two doors down. So it's Bruce Jenner revealing herself now as Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of, what was it, Vogue?
Vanity Fair.
Oh, wow. Oops, Vogue. Sorry. Vanity Fair. And then, you know, to essentially, I think, overwhelming support from the usual suspects and naysaying from the usual suspects. And then several weeks later, we had the news item about Rachel Dolezal.
Yes. Dolezal.
The Seattle NAACP president who was revealed to have been a white woman living her life as a black woman for apparently, I'd say, maybe at least over 10 years. So at the time, I saw people saying, well, if Caitlyn Jenner can come out as a woman, why can't Rachel Dolezal come out as a black woman? And so it led me to ask the question. Obviously, I was frustrated because I thought that was really a stupid question, but it sort of caught on with people. And so I thought, well, maybe I'm being an idiot and I'm missing the boat. Are these two things remotely related first? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
I have been studious in avoiding conversations about Rachel Dolezal. I am pleased that she has been knocked out of the news cycle by some really great
horrible
and
things.
Some really great tragic events in the past week, things that people should really be caring about. But to your point, so this whole transgender thing and then the word transracial got thrown around, it got co-opted. Yes. You know, transracial actually means something.
Yes.
It means, you know, transracial adoptees does not mean that you are pretending to be something you're not, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I think people are sort of not understanding fundamentally, again, what transgender is about. Transgender is about gender, which is an experience that you have that's not passed down to you from your parents, and when you come out as transgender, you are trying to live through a truth, right? This is who I am on the inside. That's just my personal experience. When you talk about race, race is hereditary. It's not simply the feeling you have. As a matter of fact, everything you have about, everything you understand about being your race, you inherit from your society and from your family. You can't simply co-opt that and decide one day that you are black, that you are Asian. That's not about living out your truth. That is very much about perpetrating and committing some sort of fraud or lying. It's not similar to Caitlyn Jenner. See, when people conflate these things, what they want to say is that Caitlyn Jenner is pretending, that she's not really a woman, she's just pretending to be a woman. But that's not what's happening there. That these things should be divorced of each other. Rachel Dolezal, this is someone who has a mental illness and she's having it in the public sphere. And it's discomforting. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Jason, what's your take?
Well, I'm not certain that she has a mental illness, although it's possible. I think I mostly agree with what you're saying. I think the two things I would point out. One, I think it's worth taking just a moment to say, like, fundamentally, gender and race, I mean, these are social constructs. And so I think it is worth taking just a moment to point out that, you know, both of these instances that you brought up, Tricia, I mean, they really do kind of highlight, you know, the fact that we social constructs are so powerful for us as human beings. Now, that said, the thing with, you know, when I look at these two situations and how they're different, to me, the big problem, I mean, we could say it's always problematic for someone to claim to be of another race, it probably is, but I think where it's particularly problematic, and I think that this situation falls into it, is when someone of one race is benefiting in a meaningful way by claiming to be of another race or by emulating another race. And so in this case, we have someone who is drawing a salary and who has established herself as a public figure with a certain stature by claiming to be of a different race. And that's really problematic. I mean, you know, you, in this case, you're talking about someone who's benefiting financially and otherwise by claiming an identity that for many, many people it brings about a lot of disadvantages. And so you have someone who is reaping the, you know, a one of the few advantages, let's say, of being black from a professional and financial standpoint, without having to live through the disadvantages that people who are black in our society often have to live through. The point I'm trying to make, though, is that, like, if this woman were going around saying she were black, but happened to be impoverished and didn't have a job where she was benefiting from being black, I'm not sure we would care that much. I don't know that, I mean, I don't speak for myself. Like, I mean, it certainly wouldn't make the news, right? And so I think what's particularly problematic and disturbing about this is not just that we have a white person who's misrepresenting herself as black, but she's benefiting financially from it.
Trisha?
Well, I mean, I think at this juncture, I mean, my sense of it, though, is that people are actually just confused. I think they've heard the term social construct, and I think that they believe that a social construct means that something is entirely fluid. So, you know, they've heard the notion that race is a social construct and that gender is a social construct, and I think they're imagining that they then get to decide things about those terms, those two labels. So I think it's actually a misunderstanding. I think it's a just like people are misunderstanding the term transracial. And actually, I don't even know if they even misunderstood it. I think they just created it, not knowing that the term actually existed for something very specific. So I think, and I saw a Democracy Now, I think, talk, and I think it was a CUNY professor who really clarified that even if something is a social construct, it has repercussions in the real world. So yes, we can talk about the fact that race has been constructed throughout time and that maybe those terms don't even mean what we think they should mean and all of those kinds of things, but there are real consequences for people who are of different races. And I think the same thing happens for gender too. There are real consequences when you decide that you're going to exist in the world as one or the other. So it's not a kind of like, hey, today I get to decide I'm going to be a man. Tomorrow I get to decide I'm going to be a woman. I mean, it's not, that's not what it means that when we say it's a social construct. I think when we say it's a social construct, we're saying that it's not attached to something biological and objectively understood by everyone, right?
But it doesn't make it any less important, or it doesn't make it any less of a transgression. And I'm talking specifically about Rachel Dolezal. Like, I have a real problem with what happened here. For a bunch of reasons.
I don't want to get caught in that. Because you see, what I'm having a problem with people confusing them, and I think that's really valuable because the confusion is revealing that people don't actually understand transgender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about, and I don't think that people are doing it to be rude or insulting or anything. I really think that they're saying, if I have to accept Bruce becoming Caitlin, why can't I accept Rachel becoming black? You call
again,
those two things constructs.
Social construct. Well, that's the problem, though. Because when you just throw out on the table, oh, these are social constructs, so they're exactly the same, aren't they? No, they're not. Like I said earlier, gender is not race. Like, race is hereditary. Like, you can't pass gender down.
Well, you can pass sex down, and you can pass sex, and you can pass identities around sex down.
But wait. Let's not get lost in this, right? You can't pass gender down, right? So you can pass gender roles down in
exactly.
That you can instruct along with society, like, how people are supposed to behave, or rather that there are different roles in society that different people inhabit. But
yes.
Race is something hereditary, right? That's something that comes from your parents, from your family, wherever you live, right? Whoever raised you, it comes from them. That experience comes from you growing up and having someone else guide you through the way that society is reacting to you based on that. And yes, these things are social constructs, but they're really different.
See, that's the thing. I don't think people understand those differences.
I'm agreeing with you.
No, but I think the presentation that you're giving back to me as if it's a given, I think that we have to explain. I think we have to think about why those two things are so confusing and where people are entering the conversation. Because I do actually, I don't want to walk around thinking that people are malicious, but I actually do think that people are trying to find ways to marry these terms so they understand why one person is rejected. Because by the way, I mean, I will say that some of the people who I saw who were reacting to kind of the negative Rachel Dolezal elements were black people. So black people were misunderstanding how those two things are supposed to be starkly different. Because they're not thinking about race the way you just defined it. They're thinking about race as kind of group behavior, group identity, social roles prescribed by race. I mean, that's how they're defining those terms. Because, you know, yes, you can say race, I can look at you and I see that you're black and this, and it's the same thing. I can look at you and I see you are female because you are XY and you are XX, or, you know what I mean? So that's become very confusing for people. I think we have these kind of large-scale conversations where we never clarify our terms. And then we run roughshod and we tell people that they have to accept things, but we don't really lay the groundwork for those kinds of conversations.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's unfortunate. I think I'll go back to something I said earlier. Transgender people are trying to live their truth. Rachel Dolezal was living a lie. She was living a lie. She was perpetrating because, as Jason says, it brought her social and some financial advantage. She went out of her way to hide this fact. And the other problem I have with this, the difference between transgender and whatever it is this crazy woman was doing, is that if the Klan showed up at her house, I'm sure she would pull that nasty weave out of her head in a second, be like, I'm white, because she can always go back.
Right.
Transgender people, as they are being stalked and killed, because transgender violence is a humongous problem, they are not stepping up being, no, really, I'm a boy, no, really, 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 because they're not lying. They are being exactly who they are.
And I think
these two things are terrible.
I think you're right, but I think the question of what part of them is lying has been the challenge. And I think maybe part of why people have been so resistant to this idea of even conflating the two is this notion that you have choice, right? You, Rachel Dolezal, like you said, if something bad were to happen and it was going to be happening to black people, she can be like, she can pull off her wig and say, "Whoa, I'm not black." But I think everyone believes both people are lying, and it's just a matter of which part of the lie you believe. She spent her whole life lying about being black, but so did Bruce spend his whole life lying about being whichever side of that equation.
Well,
so, I mean, you know, and that's what...
Though.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I think a massive re-education about these terms that I think in a kind of postmodern world, we kind of screwed up for people. I will say that, because I think when I was growing up, these things seemed very fixed, right? The universe seemed very fixed. We never really talked about things as social constructs. That became quite sexy when I was like in tail end of my high school year, and then that was all about college, right? I mean, it's the same thing.
But as, what's like, your as, point?
I mean, my point is that I think we're always trying to figure out how to get people to get on board with certain issues without ever revisiting or visiting the ground first.
Mm-hmm.
We say to people, you're just an ignorant fool. And I think we have to kind of do better than that. You know, we have to kind of, unpack some of these things.
It's so much easier to just say people are ignorant fools. It's just so convenient.
I know! It is, right?
Also, that makes for the sexier soundbite. That's easier.
Absolutely. Our whole cable news is like founded on the concept that you can just tell people that they're ignorant fools.
Yes. I mean, I want to. I really do. I really want it to be very dismissive, as I said when I introduced the topic. I did. But then I saw people who I really fairly, I respected some to some degree, raise that. And I thought, wait a minute. why is there some confusion about this? These two things aren't related at all. And, you know, therein lies the problem.
Oh, should I go next?
Well, may as well. I think it leads into it to some degree.
You know, by the time anyone hears this, it's pretty much going to be the law of the land, marriage equality. The Supreme Court came back saying that marriage equality is the reality and the law in all 50 states, marking the end of a very long march towards this. The world just responded with so much good feeling, and the White House was lit up in rainbows, Empire State Building was lit up in rainbows, Niagara Falls, Washington Monument, like every possible landmark was lit up in rainbow colors. 26 million people changed their profile pictures to rainbows in support, of course, LGBT people, but also straight people, people who live in suburbs who just felt really good about the idea that everyone would be able to marry who they wanted. Famous people, from Arnold Schwarzenegger to a bunch of blonde actresses whose names I didn't bother to find out. It was like a real groundswell of emotion for a lot of the country, and which left me thinking, how is it that the Black Lives Matter movement could not catch the same fire? Why is it that we had 26 million people change their profile pictures in support in one day, when people are actually being killed, we could not, as a movement, communicate the importance of that in the same way? How did we get here? Like, how did this movement catch such fire? Why is it so sexy in a particular way? How did we all embrace this LGBTQ movement and not Black Lives Matter? And also the other underlying question I will entertain is that, you know, we compare the LGBT movement to Black Lives Matter a lot, I think because they are the civil rights struggles of our time. But should these two things even be in the same basket? So, Jason, pick any corner of that.
So, I'll be honest. I don't really claim to have to fully understand why gay marriage has so rapidly, you know, received such overwhelming support. This keeps getting talked about. This shift in public opinion has been so massive and over such a short period of time. I don't claim to know why that is. I'm also very happy about it, but I can't explain that. I don't know. I think it's great. What I do want to say, though, is that the thing about marriage equality is that the risk of the marriage equality movement, let's say, is a very simple one. It's one that lots of people don't agree with, but it's really simple, right? I mean, the ask of the Supreme Court was, you know, say that it's legal for same-sex couples to marry in all 50 states. And that's a very simple lever for people to get on board. You know, if you're calling me, I personally volunteered a few years ago when there was a campaign to pass marriage equality in Maryland. I mean, I can remember I volunteered. I was calling random, you know, voters on the phone and saying, you know, do you support this? It's a very simple question. Black Lives Matter, the problem there, let me say this. What the ask is much harder to even know what it is. I mean, you know, you could say fundamentally, do you think unarmed, you know, black men should be able to be killed? Of course the answer is no for the vast majority of people, but it's how you address that. You know, like if this is happening in police departments, and in some cases it's maybe arguable that that police officer felt threatened, and others clearly it's a lie. But like, it's just the ask is not simple. Like if we were, you know, again, like the ask of the Supreme Court, very simple. What's the ask to solve our society's lack of I'm not even finding strong enough language. Like the fact that our society tolerates the slaughter of unarmed black men and the physical abuse of unarmed black people, including children. The fact that our society tolerates that, the remedy for that, it's just not simple. I certainly think we have to remedy it, but it's not a simple Supreme Court vote. Like, there's no vote right now the Supreme Court could make that would address this issue the way that marriage equality, not to say there won't be bumps in the road, but, like, it's the law of the land.
Tricia, what do you think? Are these movements, are they comparable? What can Black Lives Matter learn from the LGBT movement?
Nothing. Because I don't actually think they are comparable in a certain way. I mean, I think that basically the phrase that emerged out of marriage equality was love is love. Who rejects that? Very small amount of people. Because really what the marriage equality movement did was simply convince people that gay people deserved to live like heterosexuals. That was it. That they didn't, and we already see the problems with marriage equality, because that's a low-hanging fruit even for that community. because the end game for the end game for LGBTQ folks is for people to actually really appreciate difference. Mm-hmm. Right. So what happened was they didn't come to a place where they appreciated difference. They simply said, you can do what we've been doing. That's an easier sell. Because what you ended up seeing were images of people who you could almost say, hey, they're not even gay. Look at them. Do you know? But it's not in your face. There was nothing overt. Just think about the messages and the imagery that was used to sell marriage equality. It was all very much heteronormative. That's what it was. And so that's easy. That's an easier leap for someone to make. But the real difficult piece of that movement are the last two letters, right? The transgender. Like, that's mm-hmm. those are differences. People are going to have to – people have to take a leap there.
Well, and I think Tricia, can I want to ask you something, though. I mean, it's really interesting hearing you put the way you're putting it. I'm going to ask this question. This is really an authentic question. It's not one I've thought of before. Based on what you just laid out, that, like, in some ways the heteronormative approach – to making the case of love is love, you know, is how you get a lot of people on board who maybe weren't before. So let's say there was a campaign where a group of black mothers, and maybe black mothers who've lost, you know, children, whether they're as children or adult children, to, you know, violence, unprovoked violence, that was racially, you know, along race lines of race. If they appealed to white mothers and said, we wish our kids were able to walk down the street. Like, when our kids left our houses, we had the same peace of mind that they weren't going to become victims of violence that was completely undeserved, that you have, the comfort you have when your kids leave the house. I feel like the logic you're laying out, I'm not disagreeing with this, this is an authentic question, I feel like that kind of campaign would be effective.
I think it would. I think it would be very effective.
Because
I do.
That's not what I thought you were going to say.
I do. You know what I do? Because I think, because let's be honest, marriage equality is where we were with civil rights in the 60s.
I mean voting.
Right? Yes, with voting. Because what you were able to do was, and think about the way people went about trying to convince the world that we deserve the right to vote. We dressed in suits, so we played respectability politics. That's what gay people have done. They've played respectability politics. Look at us, we're clean. We're and so if you can, any time you can create a moment of connection, look. This person is dressed nicely, look at her hair, look at all of that. Because think about what happens when a violent act, when something happens to someone that's black and they're killed. What is the image that's sold to the media immediately? Right away, you see this person flashing gang signs. Because right away, you want to create this moment of disconnect. This is that's not true. A human
yeah.
being.
It's
not
a human being. Trayvon Martin, yeah. he had marijuana yeah. in his system. Yeah. He's been suspended from school. He had a hood on. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that. And so in some weird way, actually, I think what's making the Black Lives Matter movement so difficult is because it actually is throwing away respectability politics. We tried respectability politics. For 40 years we've tried respectability politics. Look at us. We're gonna go get jobs. We're gonna get well educated. We're gonna do all the things that you say we're gonna need to do.
But do you want to revisit your initial answer to the question then? Like, can Black Lives Matter actually learn anything from the LGBT movement?
Yeah, because that's
no, I mean, because you know what? It can, listen, remember, you said the question was, what are we selling you? Because remember, one of the things that's also emerged out of this discussion around post-marriage equality is that, you know what, you... gay couples are still discriminated in with housing. They're still just, they could be, you could be fired from your job. There are no protection. There are no protections there either. So yes, while everybody's changing their Facebook thing to equality, how is that going to permeate how they live and breathe their lives? Yes, that's, and so that's where Black people live now. Yes, you have the right to vote, but how is this, how are you going to really live your day-to-day lives? Okay. How are you? I mean, I suspect that if voting for Black people was happening in an era when we had social media, everybody might have put up a Black power fist. Yeah, we're on board with this. You know what I mean? But when you actually then see how it plays out in people's lived everyday world, that's where the real struggle is going to become.
I would say, I'm going to combining the things that both of you have said, right? I feel like, Jason, you're absolutely on point when you say that the ask for the gay rights movement was very specific. It was sort of very stroke of the pen. Yep. We just needed a group of people to decide something. And once they were decided it, it would just sweep over the land like a carpet of locusts, right? That would be it. I don't know why I said that.
Nothing good comes with locusts, but anyway.
Gently falling snowflakes.
Yes, like, thank you, Jason. Like, gently falling snowflakes. You know, and I think, so I've been constructing, like, you know, Trisha, and the question I asked you, I've been really thinking about this all day, like, well, how can Black Lives Matter in some way co-opt this? Like, this was extremely successful. The marriage equality movement was extremely structured. It was very well funded, and that message was marketed like the best quality product you've ever seen, right? And just think about the last 20 years, how this was slowly unveiled to the public, and now look where we are. And I've just been thinking, like, what kind of stroke of the pen legitimacy can we ask for? And Jason,
you know, it can't happen, because you know the one thing you've forgotten?
Hold on one second. So, Jason, what you mentioned before is sort of, if we selected an agenda, right, that was specific, maybe not simple, but specific, such as we need to, as a country, repeal the Rockefeller drug laws, right? We need to change this across the country. You must not be arrested for small amounts of pot that adversely affects our communities, right? That would release Black men back into the population. That's one thing. Then, of course, there'd be other things like education and jobs and the rest of it. But this is something that if we isolated one aspect that could help the community, could that work? If it's not Rockefeller drug laws, maybe it's universal preschool. You know, we know that we see the effects that if you send a kid to preschool, that has effects to that determines, not determines, but it influences their college graduation rates. What if we selected something like that? Could that work, Trish?
You know what it is? You know what will work? Because this is the thing. The other thing that we don't really want to ever really say, but it's kind of something that's been coming up, and I usually roll my eyes, but now I really get it. You know what would work? All lives matter. And I've hated that, but because, you know, the tendency, most people who say that tend not to be Black people, and they usually act in a way as to say defensively, no, let's not separate any group out. And I think that that's a real problem, and I think it's a real problem and a real challenge for people, because I think Black lives is not inclusive enough for them. Love is love, and marriage equality included them. So if you can say to someone, all lives matter, and let's define what that all lives matter mean, which is all the things that you just said, universal health care, you know,
preschool,
equal
access,
universal preschool, access to education, all of these kinds of things that happen in other places when the population is more homogeneous. I think you could possibly run on that All Lives platform. Because in a weird way, the Black Lives Matter platform, while I love it and I get it because I understand difference and I appreciate it, I know that it's kind of, people feel like it's too exclusionary. I can't.
What do you think?
Full disclosure here. Prior, so I've been equally, not happy with the All Lives Matter hashtag. But when you were talking earlier, Trisha, when you were talking about the, the heteronormative approach to getting the country behind marriage equality, I was actually thinking that. I'm thinking taking Chris's question, maybe what Black Lives Matter could learn is if you say All Lives Matter, which everyone could very happily put on their Facebook page, and then, a black person gets killed for no good reason, then you have a platform to go back to and say, hey, all you white people that agree that all lives matter, look at this, and maybe that's how you get some outrage. I actually was thinking about saying it, and then I thought, as the only white person on this podcast, I was not going to advocate for All Lives Matter, and I'm not necessarily advocating for it, but I have to based on this conversation, I am looking at it in a different light, I have to say.
I think it's the way.
What you said, this reminds me of when Raven Simone gave a series of really crazy interviews, and in one of the interviews she said that she doesn't really see herself as an African-American, she sees herself as an American, and Black Twitter, they got pieces of wood together, quickly hammered them down, and they threw poor Raven Simone up on that cross. I think she was onto something. When Raven Simone says that, oh, I'm an American just like Ann Coulter, just like Elizabeth Hasselbeck, just like whoever, just like any other American, then certain things become true, right? It's very All Lives Matter. So then when I tell you that Americans are being killed in the street and their killers are getting away with it, you clutch your pearls. What? Americans are being killed? But when you hear, Black Americans, then you're like,
what else is new?
Because know what? I saw a meme on Facebook, and someone tweeted this. It was like, it said, Black people be like, yo, stop killing us. And people are still like, but,
It's true. I mean,
I think you're onto something, Trish. I think all lives have to start.
There's a social psychology behind it. It's really about wanting to belong. And it's kind of like, we can talk about why people, wince when you tell them they can't use the N-word. But I actually have been really thinking about it because of a recent controversy, because the president used it in a very educational context, which is I'm completely fine with. I think it's because someone says don't do. When someone says you can't be here, this doesn't belong to you, it's really a double leap for some people to say, you know what, I understand that that's your space and I want to respect that space and you deserve to have that space. But if I say, come on in, be a part of my space, that's just so much, it just feels more welcoming. All Lives Matter feels more welcoming. And so I really, that's the platform that I think people would get on board for. Because then you say, what do all children deserve? All children deserve to walk down the street unafraid of being shot by a stray bullet. What mother wouldn't, embrace that idea?
I like it.
I think it's really important that we at some point get DeRay McKesson and Erica Totten on a future podcast for you to have this conversation with one or both of them on it, because I'm sure there would be a lot of pushback. Sure. And I'd love to hear that debate play out, because I feel like right now Chris and I are both like, wow, Trisha, you may be honest.
But listen,
I'd love
listen.
To hear someone be like, hell no.
No, listen, listen. No, you know what? I haven't lost my mind, because I understand.
No, I don't think
but I understand the listen, because one of the things that Chris said was, how do we get support? I'm not saying that you change people's hearts and minds fully, right? Because we're talking about, this is expedient.
This is coalition building. I mean, what you're talking about, it's organizing. It's political organizing. I totally agree. It's not that people are fundamentally changing, because that's what we're not really capable We don't know how to fundamentally change other people, but there are things you can do. You can package
things
in a way to get them on board. Exactly. Yeah, I think you're right.
All right. I say we leave it there. We've solved one problem so far. So let's keep moving. Let's move on
to the
next
thing. Another one.
Yeah. So Jason,
wouldn't it be aligned with both of our major political parties' platforms to draw the line in terms of where government authority ends at the exterior of the body? And I say that because of this. You know, first of all, I think public policy is about drawing lines. I mean, we know there are just not hard and fast rules. Like, from a moral perspective, like, there aren't usually hard and fast rules. There's usually gray. So you got to figure out where to draw the line. And to me, this line would make a lot of sense. For the Democrats, you know, I think that this would be an argument for being pro-choice. It's like, look, as long as pregnancy occurs in a woman's body, it's the woman's body, and the government does not enter the woman's body in terms of making rules about what a woman does with her own body. And getting to the mass incarceration issue that we touched on earlier, you know, we know that our laws about what people can and can't put into their own bodies are leading to, or have led to, enormous rates of incarceration, particularly of people of color, but of all kinds of people. And, you know, I know the Democratic Party claims to care about, you know, this issue and not want a lot of people incarcerated and wanting advancement and equality in the law. And then on the Republican side, you know, just given the growing resentment in the Republican Party of government authority, period, and interfering in the lives of people, you know, just like the Republican Party, it seems to me it would be totally in line with their platform to say, we're not going to let the government tell us what we put into our bodies. Like, that's an individual choice. We're not going to accept the government as a nanny in that sense. And so my question is, isn't that the case that this would align with both parties? And if it is, why do we not hear major efforts on either party's part, at least on the drug side of this, to like end the war on drugs and say, like, we're not going to tell people what to put in their bodies. If people become addicted, we're going to treat it as a health
issue.
Well,
because the Republican Party, I notice how swiftly and suavely you can join Republican and Libertarian, right? That doesn't mean the same thing in American politics, because Republicans have the albatross around their neck, which is the Christian right. So, which is very much about telling people what to do with their bodies and their souls. So, I mean, on one hand, I want to agree with you, right? But it's only in the most academic of senses. The Republican Party couldn't get by on saying that we don't care about abortion or drugs are not a problem, they should be legal if you do what you want to do. It just, and I'm not going to say it's the cornerstone of their party, because I'm not so naive, but you follow what I'm saying? Like,
no, that's a good point. What about the Democrats, though?
What about the Democrats? Like, why don't they?
Why aren't they ending the war on drugs?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, listen, I mean, I actually think this is a really important question to be asked, because it's clear to me that the Republicans specifically are losing the kind of these kind of touch point issues, right? What do we call these kinds of issues? They're social mores, something along those lines.
So next.
So I actually think it would be perfectly fine and probably nice for them to this spiral that they found themselves in by taking that stance, by saying, listen, we favor small government.
Who are you talking about, the Republicans?
Yes.
Or the Democrats? Oh, okay.
The Republicans. Because I feel as if they're losing that. They're losing all of those social conduct battles, because I think because many of them really rest on assumptions of a kind of perfectibility about people that is just, it's hard. They themselves are getting caught as well, so they can't do the prescriptive thing anymore. I mean, I actually think, you know what, I think Jason might be onto something, and I think they might end up arriving at this place some years down the line when they try to recalibrate how to sort of regain a footing with the American public in a way that is compelling and exciting. Because I think I think what we're seeing now is what? Repercussions of actions they took in the 70s, right? Around kind of this prescriptive kind of Christian right fielding thing that's happened to them. And so now that party's being eaten alive by these ideas. So I think the ground might very much be warm for them to begin to say, you know what? We've gone too far with social prescriptions.
Good luck, because the Christians are going to...
Not the current group. The current group can't do it, because that party's eaten up by them. But I do think that there's room for the Democrats, like you would say, Jason, to actually really reverberate with that message.
But
and
I have
actually
to say, though, the people
capture
who would
the
benefit,
moderates.
The people who would benefit from it are probably Republicans, though.
Ultimately, in the end, they will, because what will happen is, see, this is the thing... Ultimately, what would happen if you're able to sort of create a platform where this becomes the emerging way to talk about certain social issues, then they can move back comfortably into this space, and then their economic policies, their external foreign policies, and then come back to the fray. Right now, their party's being eaten alive by these issues that are really domestic and silly. So if you can kind of reframe domestic policy issues in this way, I think it frees them up. Yeah, ultimately very expensive. And so, I think it's a long... But I think for Jason's sake, I think it's long-term planning. I think just like the people in the 70s, and what was that group, the John whatever group that decided that this is how they're gonna try to take over the Republican Party, someone... now has to reconceive of it in this way, and I think they'll see the repercussions of it like 10, 12 years down the line.
Shouldn't that be the Tea Party, though? I mean, if the Tea Party is about what they say they're about,
they're not,
they
though.
Yeah,
they should have been. No, I mean, realistically, if the Tea Party really had the libertarian elements that they claim to have, which instead of just basically your usual crockpot racist, because if you, that's the weird thing about the Tea Party, you push on its stomach enough, and its ugly middle breaks right open.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. Wow, that was super vivid and disgusting.
No, but I mean, that's right. If all you cared about was higher taxes, there's a whole host of issues that you should be pushing the Republican Party to take on, and you're just not, because all you're doing is trying to undermine Obama.
Yeah, because realistically that emerged, and I mean, maybe there was something that happened initially, maybe the first few groups that emerged, maybe they were really about something real, but maybe the group just got co-opted like most things do. But yeah, I mean,
well, I don't want to completely like take over your topic, Jason, but it's sort of along the same lines, because now in my head I'm thinking about who is going to be the first to grab the libertarian ring, like who is going to stand up for these issues. And I'm just thinking about the Republican Party, because I think if anything, the last week, the events of the last couple of weeks have shown us that the Republican Party is losing steam, it's losing ground. These ideas that are entrenched with them are losing popularity. From the Confederate flag to gay marriage to Donald Trump being roundly laughed out of town and out of his million-dollar contracts for statements that he made that I feel like Ronald Reagan was making about black people just 30 years ago. You know, like mm-hmm. there is a total shift happening. So where do the Republicans go? Can they go this way? Does this make sense? Is this the opposition? What's the opposition party to the Democrats look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, what I find interesting and disappointing is that, so, you know, I'm not terribly enamored with any of the Republican presidential candidates, although
all 27 of them.
Yeah, like it's amazing. You have that many, and I still
find
most of them deplorable. But the couple that I actually think have done good things and have some common sense ideas that are good
Name
for the
one.
Country. I would say now let me finish though, because I'm
here we go.
No, let me finish. So Jeb Bush and Chris Christie are people that. Can I finish? Can I finish before you complete?
I'm not sure you can actually. But go ahead.
No, I mean, there are two guys that I don't agree with them on everything, but I think they've got good ideas on public education. I think that they have shown effective leadership to some extent, more Jeb than Chris Christie. And yet, on this issue that I'm bringing up, like this issue of reducing mass incarceration and ending the war on drugs, I don't think they show any promise or interest, and it's very frustrating. And like, just full disclosure, like the vast majority of the Republicans who are running for president, like I can't see myself ever in a gazillion years voting for. I'm not saying I would vote for Jeb Bush, but he's someone I could be persuaded to vote for, but I'm so disappointed that he's not taking this issue on wholeheartedly.
I mean, who would emerge? You said who emerges as
what's the opposition party to the Democrats look like? The Republicans are losing ground. What do they grasp now?
What, you know what they grasp? I mean, it's kind of like when you do you go back to religious orthodoxy, right? You go back to your root, right? And you say to yourself, we have lost our way, just like we believe America has lost our way, and we are going to reconceive of ourselves as a party for the American people. It's like the All Lives Matter. And then you say to yourself, well, what are the things that are going to raise up all of America? And you recalibrate it back around to economics, which has always been their issue. But you can't, like, I mean, I don't think you, I just think you sort of move past some of these kind of stumbling block, abortion, blah, 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 all of those kinds of issues, and just go, listen, you know what? That's your business. They can take that issue up. They can take it that way.
Hi, it's Chris from the future. Just a reminder that this was recorded like over a year ago. So these recommendations you're about to hear are a little stale, and we talk about them as if they're present. But remember, they're not.
So, Jason, why don't you start?
So I, years ago, actually, I was in your apartment, Chris. You weren't there. I can't remember why this was, but you had a DVD of the first season.
What the hell?
Of...
What were you doing in my apartment?
Well, no, I mean, you had said I could go there, but like, I don't, it was really weird. I remember you had a DVD there of the first season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I hadn't really seen it before. I watched an episode and a half, and I had to turn it off because I found Larry David's character so excruciating. And yet, recently, I have, like, decided to give it another shot, and I've been really into it. And I do, it's actually a perfect thing, I think, to talk about cooling outrage, because his character is so outrageous, and there is so much racism and just, like, so much angst around his character. And yet the fact, I think what I realize now, the reason it does cool my outrage is because every episode he is defeated. I mean, that is, like, every single episode Larry David's character is defeated, and there's just something, it's funny, and it's also, like, there's just something, pleasing about that.
I love that show. I love it, love it, love it. It's so funny, Trisha.
What's cooling my outrage is a meditation on I watched the Nina Simone documentary on called What Happened, Miss Simone, and it's been on my mind. And I haven't been angry or anything like that. I've just been contemplative because she lived a very fascinating life. And so I even got my sister to watch it the following day. I might rewatch it again this week. I think it just raised a lot of interesting questions about dreams deferred. And I don't know. I found it fascinating because, you know, one of the things that people always say is that you should get out of your own way and let life kind of take you on its own journey, and she do that.
You said she did do that.
I've been thinking
that
she didn't, for, you know, just an overcast of just a quick sense of it is that, you know, her dream was to be a classical pianist. That was her biggest dream, but she enjoyed doing something else, and she never embraced that other thing that she was famous for. She mm-hmm. to the very end of her life, she regretted the fact that she was not able to be a classical pianist. And so I thought to myself, wow, that's harsh.
Yeah.
Because aren't you supposed to be grateful for the thing that happened to you instead? Mm-hmm. So, it's just been, you know, I've just been thinking about it. It's been percolating in the back of my mind, trying to figure out what lessons to learn from it. Okay. It's great. So, it's a great documentary. Yeah. It's on Netflix. It's great. I highly recommend it.
Mine is, I'm going to say this several times, spoiler alert. Mine is the Lifetime movie A Deadly Adoption, starring Kristen Wiig. And what's his name? Oh my God, Ron Burgundy. Oh my God, Will Ferrell.
Yeah,
Will Ferrell.
That guy.
So spoiler alert.
Yeah.
So this has been in production for a while, and it's very hush hush. No one talks about it. They won't do any interviews about it. No one wants to talk about it. And it finally hit the airwaves. I think a week or two ago, I finally got around to watching it, and I was like, Will Ferrell, Kristen Wiig on a Lifetime movie. This is going to be over the top. Spoiler alert. This is your final spoiler alert. If you haven't seen it, this movie, right, was a Lifetime movie. And by that, I mean that this was some, like, next step comedy. So get this ready. Get ready for this, right? So Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig make a Lifetime movie, and the joke is there's no joke. It is a straight-up Lifetime movie. Millions of people got punked into watching a Lifetime movie thinking it was going to be funny, but it was straight serious.
Wait, it wasn't funny?
No, that's the joke. And I was floored by that's this awesome. Next level comedic stunt.
Yeah.
People, I mean, I watched the whole thinking like, oh, is this going to be like a take on it? Is it going to be over the top? No. They just used every trope that is always present in Lifetime movies, right? Like, and then the movie ended. That
no,
was it.
No way.
You got punked. Let me tell you something.
The joke was, that was the joke. It was so genius. At the end, I was watching on the train. At the end, I just slow clapped to myself. I was like, I was taken. I was ready to go.
I find that fascinating. I mean, I've seen Kristen Wiig play dramatic roles, so I can see that. Will Ferrell, I just can't imagine watching for more than 2 minutes without laughing. Like, I really can't
imagine
that.
That's the thing, because I watched the first half hour, and, like, everything they did, I was like, okay, here comes the joke. It just all felt like a setup, and I realized that I was the joke.
Yeah. You
and
were
I
taken
thought,
for a ride.
I thought it was brilliant. I do not recommend anyone watch it unless you like Lifetime movies. But
that's awesome.
If you were similarly fooled, I have to say, bravo, you two. So that's all we have for you now. So hopefully you'll listen to us again for Jason and Patricia. I'm Chris, and thanks for listening to Outrageous. Bye.
Bye.